The bullets fly. Hissing bees, deadly stingers, they bite the earth in front of the slit trench. Within the trench, heads bent like penitent sinners. Kurt Muller and Helmut Weber gripped their Panzerfaust, their shaking fists white with tension, their legs trembling with nerves. On April 24th, these two boys were the front line on one street in Spandau, where two massive Soviet armies sought to link up and seal off Berlin forever. Kurt and Helmut stood in their way, if you can call trembling in a foot of muddy water and involuntarily jerking at every loud noise standing. They had known each other for years, members of the same FON, or flag group. The two teens had trained and worked with each other for 7 of their 17 years. Both boys have served in the Young Folk together, and when they graduated to the Hitler Youth at age 14, they were still in the same FON. Kurt and Helmut were also from the same small town in East Prussia, and they had been through many trials over the last 7 years. All of those trials had pointed to this one day. They had prepared for this battle their entire lives, as long as they could remember. Days of marching, countless lectures on the ideals of National Socialism, and countless war projects, digging and modifying trenches, setting up fields of fire. These had been their lives for years, and now the day of ultimate sacrifice had come. But Helmut had never fit into anyone's ideas of the perfect Nazi youth. Brown-haired and bespectacled, he preferred books to the field, his own bed to the campfire, not like Kurt. Kurt was everything Helmut was not, blonde, tall, lean, with striking sky-blue eyes, forthright and bold. Kurt had always been the leader of the FON. Today was no different. As the two sat huddled in the bottom of the mud-weeping slit trench straddling a suburban townhome-lined road, Kurt constantly tried to harden Helmut's resolve to continue the fight, to never give up, to endure all the way to the bitter end. So many of their comrades, boys they had known for years, boys they had endured hardships with, trained with, marched with, shared their last drops of precious water with, on endurance hikes, these same comrades and folk kinsmen had abandoned their fighting positions. Kurt and Helmut looked around themselves and saw the empty foxholes of their comrades, the way a lonely retiree views the empty seats of a matinee movie theater. Only Kurt and Helmut remained. The rest of their battle group were either dead or deserted. It's good the others are gone. Now we don't have to worry about them sapping our morale. Kurt nodded as he spoke, his blonde hair playing in front of his piercing eyes like kites, leisurely trembling in the wind. Men like that are terrible for a unit's cohesion. Helmut looked around the trench for the so-called unit. It was just him and Kurt. There was no unit. But Helmut wouldn't say anything like that. That kind of cynical talk was cowardice. And even though Helmut rationally knew there was no unit, his heart made his head nod in agreement with Kurt nonetheless. Helmut observed Kurt. He was a man worth dying with. Helmut had never led anything in his life, but Kurt, even now, was scanning the distance for any signs of Russians, checking and rechecking his rifle, cleaning and re-cleaning it, reading from his pocket Ich Kampf handbook, his lissome muscles toned and graceful like a panther. Kurt was unbelievable. He actually looked like Nietzsche's Übermensch. Helmut did none of these things. He knew their combat position was hopeless. He didn't scan the surrounding townhomes for the enemy. He sat on a wooden ammunition box and concentrated on Greta Fischer's face. She had gone to school with Helmut. He had been too cowardly to speak with her. Why didn't he at least try to talk to her? She probably would have rejected him, that's true enough, but at least he would have had closure about the thing. Still, her smiling face was all that he could think about in the seeping mud of that trench. That's when Kurt hissed, "They're coming! This is it!" Helmut nodded with resignation, the way an American anti-hero nods with acceptance of discipline in a Hollywood film. James Dean accepting his fate. Of course they were coming, thought Helmut. I'm going to die in Spandau, and I've never even been with a girl. Hell, I barely even kissed a girl. Now I'll be dead, and for all I know, Greta is dead already. They're gonna pay. I'll make the swine pay. It was Kurt. He sounded like his teeth were grinding together as he spoke, as if a demon was speaking through him. He was so excited by the prospect of his death that his voice physically changed. You hear me, Helmut? He slapped Helmut as he spoke. We're gonna get payback! My mother, my two sisters, you know what these bastards did to them! Helmut nodded. He knew. How could he not know? It was all Goebbels, and the newsreels could report murder, rape, indiscriminate torture. Helmut knew many of his own family were almost certainly dead. He accepted this calmly, but not Kurt. Kurt had wanted this day to come. Slowly. Tentatively. Helmut lobbed next to Kurt, resembling a lumbering turtle next to a vigilant eagle. Unathletic, but still good at heart, Helmut sighed. He was ready to die. You could hear the tanks coming now. In a few seconds, they would be on top of the two teenagers. Quick as the sound waves of my voice tingling your ear, Kurt shot up from the lip of the trench, every move practiced and smooth, his grip and form like a heroic statue of iron. With practice, muscle memory, he aimed the Panzerfaust with determination, spinning at death. He pulled the trigger on the rocket. Click. Nothing happened. That's when the Soviet infantry group spread out near the tank, unloaded on Kurt. Helmut watched in horror as his old friend, the leader of his flag group, the representative of his East Prussian gal, the athletic one, the one all the girls couldn't stop staring at, that's when the back of his blonde skull exploded out. Kurt's head had actually split in two unequal segments from the impact of the round, while the back of the skull had fragmented into what seemed like hundreds of pieces. Absurdly, it reminded Helmut of a jar of small candies, like those chocolate-coated M&Ms American soldiers were issued in their ration packs, shattering and exploding in a riot of color. The brain matter was already lost in the foot-deep water pooling at Helmut's feet. Kurt's cadaver lay against the backside of the trench, the headless mouth working involuntarily, the heart still beating, trying to send blood to a brain that had ceased to exist. The top of Kurt's head was gone, but the left cheek, the nose, lips, and bottom half of the right cheek still remained. Already, muck was starting to streak down the remains of Kurt's face and lips into the gaping head wound as well. Thus passed Kurt Muller, son of Hans, winner of the 12th annual Hitler Youth Games, the man who had taken Emma Schneider's virginity, who was the poster boy of Nazism in Tilsit, East Prussia. Helmut couldn't believe it. For a moment, he crouched in the trench, dumbfounded. In the meantime, the Soviet T-34 was almost upon him. At any moment, it would use its treads to cave in the trench and bury him alive. Then something snapped. And Helmut was possessed by a fury for battle. Never had a tortoise-shaped youth moved with such purpose. His clumsy body had learned something from all the years of laborious endurance training after all. Quick as a woman judges a man, Helmut popped out of the trench, every movement ungraceful and gangly, unpracticed and awkward, but in spite of himself, he let the Panzerfaust fly. The rocket found its mark. Inside, two of the Russian tank crew were already turned into tomato bisque. One of the T-34 crewmen unlatched the top hatch and was scrambling out. He was as cumbersome as a devout Christian in the middle of the Grand Mosque during Ramadan. In a second, Helmut had the rifle up and he easily found his mark. In 5 seconds, he sent two bullets into the tank crewman, whose body fell back into the tank compartment with a thump. Then Helmut exposed his torso above the trench lip, sending his rifle in a swinging circle around his left shoulder and onto his back. Now he was totally visible to any Russian in the area. He let two stick grenades fly, sending one on either side of the tank, and then ducked back down into the muck-filled bottom of the trench. 2 seconds later, the grenades exploded. Helmut, dripping with slime, could hear the shrapnel tinkling and jangling off the metal hull of the tank's frame. Then he heard something say plunk. Next to his own head, the Russians had thrown in their own grenades. In 2 seconds, it would be all over, but not yet. Helmut leapt out from the trench like a toddler jumping into the arms of his mother. Bravery beyond bravery, steel beyond steel, faster than pain. He came on, firing his rifle into the dumbfounded Russians. They couldn't believe it. Was this a man or a god who was attacking them, heedless of his own death? Using his rifle, Helmut shot one Russian point blank in the chest. One moment, the Russian was standing there, frozen in disbelief. The next moment, he was hurtling backwards, his feet straight up in the air the way children stick their legs out of the water in a pool. Slick, said Helmut's Luger as he withdrew it from his holster. He fired the next shot so fast the sounds literally bled together. First one Soviet soldier received a bullet in his throat. His Adam's apple seemed to burst out in blood when Helmut shot him. Then Helmut caught an Asiatic soldier in the right shoulder. You could see the Asian man's rifle flying through the air as Helmut lumbered on a tortoise-shaped soldier with the adrenaline-fueled speed of a tiger. That's when An invisible fist punched Helmet in the gut, making him stagger. A split second later and something shattered his tibia, splintering the main bone of his leg the way the back of a cut in a too heavy tree splinters when the tree finally falls down. Now, Helmet was spinning while his body still hurtled forward under the weight of his own momentum. Then Helmet slammed into the dust-covered concrete and he actually saw the bullets walking towards him, pinging off the pavement as the Russian marksman sought his tender body out. From the sky, you could see multiple bullets pierce Helmet Weber, son of Dieter Weber. Just imagine an overweight, nondescript boy with little volcanoes of blood bursting out all over his body, popping blood out like giant pimples. That was the way the bullets found Helmet's body on April 24th, 1945. That was also the way they found his corpse. About 30 minutes later, another Soviet T-34 tank ran over Helmet's body, spilling gore out of every orifice and wound. His cadaver resembled a used toothpaste tube flattened and rolled on the end, and thus shy Helmet met his cruel fate. Defending the streets of his fatherland to the very last, he gave his all, and his all was not enough. Oh, holy God, viewer of all our pain, all our suffering, my eyes moist with tears, my head wet with dew, I call for your unstoppable mercy. Send mercy, O Lord, send mercy. I see the blood, I see the corpses, I see the sin, I see the evil, the streets, the hills, the trees, they call for judgment. We trample your law under our feet, we turn our backs on your iron word, and now we pay the iron price. Look, even now the crow is calling, calling his brothers to the feast, where once there was plenty, now there is nothing. Where once there was pleasure, now there is pain. Where are the smiling advertisements? Where are the smirking criminals? Where is the jangling coins? There is a rod. Hear my voice, you sons of Romulus. There is an iron rod. Oh, Italy! There is a rod of judgment and a bitter cup! I hear the trumpet blowing. I see you shake your head. I see you smirk at me. The pain takes away the smirks. The death takes away the laughing. The wedding has become the funeral. The maternity wards are empty while the mortuaries burst at the seams. Edited quote from Un Canto per la Morta by Arturo Turulla. Welcome to Battlecast. I'm Dr. Luke Wolf, and today we culminate 5 months of podcasting with the Battle of Berlin. The first thing I want to do today is thank Jim from Parts Unknown, Dr. Betts from Burlington, Vermont, and Michael from Anchorage, Alaska for buying us around. And if you want to buy us around, head over to thebattlecast.com and hit that make a donation button. I also want to thank everybody who shares the show on social media and tells a friend about it. I really appreciate it. Okay, in today's episode, the battle will finally spill into the city of Berlin itself. The heart of one of the greatest powers in human history, Germany, will become a front line in a titanic struggle between two totalitarian societies. This is the definitive history of the Battle of Berlin, using sources never quoted in English before. Our major concern is not who Hitler's wife had lunch with on April 27th, or what enlightened opinion in the Western world thought about the struggle. This show is about the boys, teenagers, and fanatics fighting to the death in the middle of some of the greatest architecture the world had ever seen. Beautiful streets, modern plumbing, tree-lined gardens, this is the scene of our war tonight. Then there are the factories and government districts. No one ever imagined war would rage in those cavernous factories and echoing Senate chambers. But it did, and this is the story. It's also the story of the civilians, the millions of regular people, totally neglected by their leadership, violating the most basic assumption of all political philosophy and the Christian religion, protection, therefore obligation. The civilians of Germany, who had endured rationing for 4 years and continuous bombing for 2, these same civilians were abandoned in their hour of greatest need by the Nazi leadership. Oswald Spengler, when Hitler came to power, warned the Nazi Party about recklessly disregarding the thoughts of other nations. And I want to warn anyone listening to this, our numbers have gone up during this series, and I want you to know, you personally are not an island. The things you do affect you and those around you. The things your nation does affects you and the nations around you. The things other nations do affect you and the nations around them. There is an innate responsibility in the human condition itself. This is what liberal philosophers mean when they talk about the arc of history bending towards justice. They mean the same thing Oswald Spengler meant when he declared to Germany's new Nazi political leadership that Germany was not an island. This is the warning that went unheeded. In fact, Hitler referenced Spengler in public speeches denouncing Spengler's work in general and his warning in particular. Oswald Spengler wrote in his final book entitled The Hour of Decision the following words, quote, Germany is not an island. No other country is to the same degree woven actively or passively into the world's destiny. Her geographical situation alone, her lack of natural boundaries, makes this inevitable. For no country is it more essential that its sphere of political and economic thought should reach far beyond its own boundaries. Everything that happens far away involves the heart of Germany. Our past is taking its revenge on us. We've had 700 years of petty and small states with no greatness or aim. We can't change this mentality in two generations. The average German has a partisan and small-minded outlook. And from those ancient days to today, the German has shut himself up in his small little fatherland, measuring world history by his own landmarks and dreaming hungrily of a kingdom in the clouds. To this petty and essentially German mode of thought belong almost all the political ideas and utopias sprouting out of the Weimar swamp. Communism, pacifism, Aryan visions of sacred empire, the Soviet state, or a Third Reich. All parties now think and act as if Germany had the world to herself. And the National Socialists believe they can afford to ignore the world or just simply oppose it and build their castles in the air without creating a very palpable reaction from abroad. End quote. These words were a warning published in 1934. In 1945, the truth of Spengler's words were plain for anyone with eyes to see. Germany is not and was not an island. Her aggression inevitably provoked responses from abroad, and so Germany went under and has still not emerged and may never emerge from the terrible suction when the Third Reich sank into the sea of the pages of history. But there's also a lesson there for China's Communist Party and for Putin and for our own elite. You are not an island. Every action you take produces a reaction, both at home, which you can often crush, but also abroad, which you cannot control. When I read famous American elites, men with real influence like G. John Eikenberry, I see their charts citing the numerous nations in alliance with America and comparing them with the small number of nations aligned with China and Russia, but they miss the point. China and Russia can combine with one another and thereby negate, or at least significantly disrupt, American world order. America is not an island, but for the past 30 years, our elite have thought of itself as an island, declared unilateral wars, attempted to remake cultures in their own image, molested ancient religions in their ancient homelands. The drug addict brings shame and pain on his family. He is not an island, and neither are you, my masters. I have no power. But I have seen your hubris, the way you treat the immigrant waitstaff at your million-dollar conferences. You don't know the disdain you signal to them. But I see, and it breaks my heart, because America is a great nation, and she deserves serious rulers who govern thoughtfully with compassion and care for the people they rule over. Do you hate the Americans you see from 10,000 feet when you look out your jets? Do you hate the small-town cafe? Do you make television programs where characters piss on their savior? I have no power and I cannot stop you, but let me be a second Spengler and warn you. Just saying there is freedom doesn't make people free. Just unilaterally dictating conditions to small governments doesn't spread peace. It merely delays the consequences. There's a reason Putin always cites the situation in Cyprus. Cyprus is a song you helped create. But when Putin makes a similar geopolitical melody, you scoff. Just telling the world they need more liberal education as your own school's performance decline doesn't spread liberal education across the globe. And when French politicians think you've gone too far, you've gone pretty damn far. When I see France, I see extreme liberality and secularism, and you're scaring them. America is not the world. I'm just a pissed-on academic, a man no one listens to, a man who waits in line to ask questions at conferences, and my questions are dodged by the speaker. And when I send emails to my political leaders because I'm desperately trying to help our country, because I love not only my own nation, but I love peace between the nations, All I get is silence, a heavy silence, a saddening, heart-rending silence. I've written and cried over emails, prayed over them, and received no response. Yet when I write French intellectuals and politicians, they respond with utmost courtesy. Why do you ignore your own people? Why do you ignore world opinion? And so I'll close this segment with these words. America is not an island. There are millions of people in Ukraine and Georgia and Armenia and Taiwan who need you to know that. What we do affects not only ourselves, but everyone in the world. You have a heavy responsibility. Please, at the very least, accept your rulership as a heavy responsibility. Don't just try to spend money to make yourself rich. Please don't use your office as a way to expand your business or get a good-paying lobbyist job when you leave office, or invest in the milk company who gets the contract to supply milk to all the schools in California. The world needs you. The citizens of this country need you. The millions of immigrants you let into this country need you. And I need you. And my personal children need you. I'm just a nobody, an academic who loves his people and his family dearly. But behind my tongue is all the ancient wisdom of the Western world. If you won't hear me, hear the voice of Homer. Hear the voice of Shakespeare, of Tolkien, and yes, Spengler too. America is not an island. Dr. Gustav Kuchenberg was a tired man. He had been unceremoniously awoken by his adjutant at 4 a.m. on April 24th. He had received a phone call from headquarters. 1 minute, Kuchenberg was enjoying the comforts of an actual bed with sheets. The next moment, he was stumbling into his SS Brigade Führer uniform. That's the problem with war. You can't get any good sleep. Kuchenberg was 67 miles north of Berlin at a training center for SS recruits. "This is Kuchenberg," the doctor said into the receiver. The voice on the other end was mechanical, far away. The telephone network of the Reich was strained. The disembodied, inhuman voice told Kuchenberg to gather his forces, the mostly French SS volunteers from the Charlemagne Regiment, and lead them into Berlin. He was supposed to go to the bunker and get orders directly from the Führer himself. Dr. Kuchenberg didn't hesitate. While he threw on the rest of his uniform, he had his men assemble outside, stepping out in his long black leather great coat, his black boots polished and clicking on the pavement stones. The eagle-faced men lined up in rows like trees in an orchard, with SS pendants and swastika flags defying the wind. The way the regime had defied the world, Kuchenberg could have been an extra in a Hollywood World War II film. But this was real life, and he addressed his men with these words, quote, "Men, I've been ordered to go to Berlin, and I intend to do my duty. The road is hard. Even now, the Russians have cut off our infiltration points. When we arrive, if we survive the journey, which we probably won't, we'll be in the middle of Stalin's main objective, the Führer's underground bunker beneath the Reich Chancellery. There we will fight to the last man, carrying out our orders unto death. No one has to come if they don't want to. This is a volunteer-only mission. Now, who wants to go to the Reich's capital with me?" End quote. Most of the men there raised their hands. A majority wanted to come. However, even in the volunteer SS, the heart of Nazi fanaticism, there were men who did not volunteer. It was just as well, because Kuchenberg didn't have enough transportation for all the men who did want to go, let alone those who didn't want to. Kuchenberg chose another 90 or 500. The sources disagree with one another on the number of men Kuchenberg took with him. Of the best men from the volunteers, because that was all the available vehicles could carry. For the record, I believe Kuchenberg had hundreds of men rather than only 90, because in his report he repeatedly claims he had hundreds of soldiers in his convoy. Jean-Marie Coisil was there. This is how he describes the scene in his book, Sous Uniforme Allemand. "We were woken up at 2 a.m. in order to assemble in a nearby village. General Kuchenberg gives us a little spiel. We have the honor of being urgently called to Berlin to participate in the defense of the capital." Kuchenberg was to take command of the Waffen-SS Nordland Division, to which our battalion is incorporated. All of this seems a little more up our alley than the hunt for Wehrmacht deserters. Our battalion war group is comprised of 250 men, and we all load up on trucks and head for the capital, end quote. Notice Jean-Marie claims that 250 men of his own unit made their way to Berlin, much more than the lower estimates of some historians. Anthony Beevor describes the men who volunteered to infiltrate into Berlin like this, quote, Many of the men were officers. Almost all were Frenchmen. These volunteers, ready to die in the ruins of the Reich, were all fanatical anti-Bolsheviks. At 8:30 a.m., they loaded up in 2 armored personnel carriers and 3 trucks and set off for the capital. It was not going to be easy to reach Berlin. Everyone was going in the other direction, and the roads were clogged with soldiers, stragglers, refugees, or foreign workers. Many army soldiers jeered at the SS volunteers, telling them that they were headed in the wrong direction. Some tapped their temples to indicate that the SS men were crazy. Others shouted that the war was as good as over, end quote. Quote, not if these 500 French men had anything to say about it. They had murder on their minds, and as the men drew closer to the city, they came under more and more attacks. First, a Soviet fighter strafed the SS column. Then, Russian artillery fingered their position. Still, the convoy pressed on. Kuchenberg knew the area well from his time as a civilian, so he led the convoy on small back roads towards the city. Many trucks were lost in the confusion on the way, and at least 90 men turned around and went back north. Kuchenberg pressed on with about 300 men. When they reached a canal whose bridge had been blown, the men carried across their supplies and made their way on foot 12.5 miles. The men were shocked that the only defenders of Berlin they encountered were 3 Hitler youth patrolling on bicycles. The Frenchmen even found well-dug-in defensive positions on major bridges unmanned and open for the Russians to take. Finally, after hours of marching with heavy supplies, the men collapsed in the Grunewald forest in southwest Berlin. The SS troopers had made it into the city. The sun had already set. Exhausted, the men slept where they fell. Jean-Marie picks up the story, quote, "All the bridges are blown out or heavily guarded by dug-in Russians. In the end, we had to abandon our trucks and continue to the city on foot. We cross a river on a bridge that has recently been bombed. Destroyed German combat vehicles are on the bridge, still smoking. Drivers and soldiers look as if they are asleep at their posts, but they're just dead. We walked for hours. Sporadic tank battles took place in the distance near us. We pass under an overpass of a motorway, over which passes a long column of Russian tanks, all headlights on. We cannot recognize them in the darkness, but judging by the few precautions they take, it cannot be ours. The noise of the close battle can be heard in all directions. We learn that the last trucks in our column get lost and likely will not be able to rejoin our group in Berlin. Approaching Berlin, we come across lone soldiers heading west. They still hope to escape Ivan in this direction, but they won't escape. One of them shouts to us in passing, 'Prepare for death!' It's an appropriate welcome to the city we have pledged our lives to defend. When we arrive in the city, there are beautiful fireworks in the sky. Rockets of all colors, lightning flashes, rumbles, explosions, showers of sparks, beams of bullet tracers. The usual sight of a battlefield at night. At daybreak, we start to receive some very scattered artillery projectiles. It doesn't last. On the other side of the river, we see T-34s moving in all directions across the terrain." End quote. An SS officer named Henri Finet remembers arriving in Berlin like this, quote, "We reached Berlin in the depth of night very late. The crackling of machine gun fire mixed with the rumbling of artillery was very near our position. We had been marching for hours ever since a bridge had been blown from under our feet and made us abandon our trucks. Harassed, we marched like robots, our muscles taut with the effects of fatigue we could feel climbing up our legs. We marched on, though, obsessed by the worry about arriving soon in the encircled capital, of not letting our way be barred from our last battle, all our existence, all our strength, going towards that goal that attracted us like moths to a light bulb, Berlin. When we arrived in the forest, the men had only one thought, sleep. Soon we were all asleep. Our last battle would come tomorrow." End quote. Meanwhile, on the morning of April 24th, Hitler was meeting with his military advisors in the Führer bunker. Now, if you remember from last month's show, the first time Hitler publicly said the war was lost was on April 22nd, when he ordered Steiner's 10,000 men and a handful of tanks to counterattack 100,000 Russians. When Steiner hadn't attacked the massive Soviet force, Hitler plunged into a depression. In the conference on April 24th, Hitler learned that the massive Russian attack that began on April 19th had succeeded in driving a wedge between German forces in the area above Berlin and the city itself. A similar thing had already happened in the area south of Berlin when Zhukov and Konev's forces surrounded the German Ninth Army. If you add all the Soviet forces together, about 2.4 million men with much more equipment and supplies were bearing down on the capital of the Reich. The only large group of organized German forces that could have conceivably counterattacked was Steiner's group. Accordingly, a military representative named Jodl made his way to Steiner's headquarters in order to command him to attack the Russians no matter the odds. "By order of Hitler, you must start the attack at once," Jodl declared. Steiner was defiant. He actually shrugged when he responded, his voice speaking in a casual tone that would have been unthinkable 3 months before. "I don't want to move towards Berlin. There's hardly any cover, and most of my men will die. I don't want to do it." John Tolan describes what happened next like this, quote, "Jodl glared at him, and his bald patch turned pink with anger, but Steiner stared him down. Steiner was convinced that only a negotiated peace with the West could save Germany, and he had secretly agreed to make contact with Eisenhower as soon as possible in order to allow the Americans and British to pass through his lines. In the middle of the argument with Jodl, Steiner was notified that 1,000 Hitler Youth and 5,000 pilots, who no longer had planes, had just arrived to augment his forces. "Mobilize them for the attack towards Berlin," Jodl ordered. Again, Steiner was rebellious. "They were untrained," he said, "and would be murdered in battle." He sent them back to their home bases. Jodl gave up and returned to Army headquarters. A few hours later, Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel arrived and urged Steiner to start the attack. Steiner was embarrassed, but he could only say, "No, I won't do it. This attack is nonsense. It's just plain murder. You can do whatever you want to me." At that, Keitel agreed Steiner's situation was hopeless, and he left, end quote. On the same morning, April 24th, General Helmut Weidling was put in charge of the defense of the actual city of Berlin, which was ironic because the day before Hitler had ordered the general executed because someone had falsely reported that Weidling had retreated from the front line, something Hitler had expressly ordered everyone not to do. When Weidling found out he was supposed to be executed, he decided to physically go to the bunker and prove he had not retreated. At the Führerbunker, he told one of Hitler's chief military advisors, General Hans Krebs, "What's going on and why am I going to be shot?" Krebs told him Hitler was infuriated because Weidling had retreated. "That's ridiculous!" Weidling declared, and promptly produced a situation map that proved his command was only 2 miles away from the Russian front line. Krebs was impressed, and instead of giving Weidling a bullet, he took him to see Hitler. During his meeting with Hitler, Weidling was put in charge of the defense of over half of Berlin. The next day, he was granted authority over the defense of the entire city. After his brief conference with Hitler, Weidling believed the dictator was planning a wild gamble with his forces in order to reverse the declining military situation of the Reich. Hitler's plan called for the Ninth Army, which, if you remember, is cut off and surrounded 20 miles below Berlin, and the 12th Army to attack the Russians south of Berlin at the same time. Meanwhile, the 12th Army was the only thing holding back the Americans and British from rolling into Berlin, so Hitler was commanding his army on the Western Front, which by now was just a couple dozen miles from Berlin, to leave the Western Front practically unguarded and attack the Russians in the east. After the 9th and 12th armies linked up and defeated parts of the Russian forces in the south, then the two combined armies would join with Steiner's small operational group and crush the Russians in the north. It was all a walk in the park, as easy as lying to a woman. Weidling walked out of the room in a daze. Was he in a dream? There was no way such a complicated plan could work, but Weidling was a simple soldier who believed in doing his duty, and so he set out to protect the heart of German culture and sovereignty, Berlin. And while Hitler was moving around ghost divisions in his bunker, Konev was preparing a massive artillery barrage. He amassed more than 3,000 guns for the strike, which came at 6:20 a.m. This amounted to more than 650 pieces of artillery every half a mile. All of these guns were pointed at the defensive Teltow Canal, one of the last barriers holding up Konev's advance in the south. Anthony Beevor picks up the story, quote, From the flat roof of an 8-story office block, a clutch of 1st Ukrainian Front commanders watch the heavy artillery demolishing the buildings across the canal and wave after wave of bombers from their supporting aviation army. The infantry began to cross in collapsible assault craft and wooden rowing boats. By 7 a.m., the 1st Rifle Battalions were across the canal, establishing a bridgehead. Soon after midday, the 1st pontoon bridges were in place and tanks began to go over, end quote. Soon they had a beachhead, and they were spreading through the rubble-strewn streets, tanks and artillery pounding centers of resistance as they came on. These weren't the only troops advancing on Berlin. All along the perimeter, on April 23rd and 24th, Soviet units were making canal and river crossings, establishing bridgeheads, and liquefying strong points one by one. Often, the Russians used cannon to literally pound buildings into rubble-strewn dust. There is an illustrative scene in the British documentary series entitled A World at War, which shows Soviet artillerymen lob a shell into a 5-story tall Berlin building. The shell first penetrates the center of the building's facade, then, a moment or two later, the facade implodes downward, sending a cloud of dust and detritus fogging through the air. Much of the building still remains standing, don't get me wrong, but after 5 or 6 more direct hits like that, not much of the building will remain. That's what the Russians did to the German fortifications and strong points. The Soviet artillerymen huffed and puffed and blew the German walls down. And the German people had been preparing Berlin for this final Ragnarok for months, even as basic services and the food supply broke down. Joachim Fest describes the state of the city at this time, quote, "Every day more factories, workshops, and utility companies discontinued operations. Frequently, there was no running water or power for hours at a time. The use of electricity for cooking was forbidden. Violators were punished with death. An unbearable stench hung over everything, a combination of burnt flesh and the garbage and rubble piled up on the softened asphalt. In the city center, people stayed for days on end in cellars and subway tunnels. Those few who risked coming out wrapped their faces in damp cloths to protect themselves against the acrid fumes from burning fires and phosphorus. The challenges of day-to-day survival seemed endless. The last issues of the newspapers and billboards combined strident victory rhetoric with threats, often next to bizarre advice about how to confront the great perils of everyday life. To improve your protein intake, one of these recommendations read, go and catch frogs in the city's rivers and lakes. The best way to catch them was by dragging colorful rags along the shallows near the shore, end quote. Still, in these conditions, tens of thousands of Germans worked to bolster the defenses of Berlin. Here's how one Axis soldier described the defenses he found when he first entered the city proper. Quote, at important road junctions, the blockades against Russian tanks were standing ready to be dragged into positions with tractors or tanks. Usually, these were trams or freight train cars filled with paving stones. Small foxholes, which had been dug in on almost every street crossing, were mostly already manned by some Volkssturm men armed with a couple of Panzerfaust. Everywhere Volkssturm soldiers could be seen, most of them with just a helmet and a badge as identification, end quote. By this time, the fighting in the north and east of the city was taking place in the city itself. It had actually moved towards the city center. An SS soldier remembered what it was like fighting in the industrial areas of the city. Quote, yet again, we were forced back. Our next position of resistance became an enormous group of factories. It became a fortress that temporarily held back the Soviet assault. The Russian losses were horrible because we could fire at them from all possible angles thanks to the location of the factory buildings. Then they put in heavy artillery. It sang and thundered all around, and the blast waves threw us, half-conscious, to and fro between the walls. The defenders, who were killed by collapsing walls, ceilings, and iron girders, numbered more than those who got a direct hit or were hit by splinters. It became unendurable to stay in this inferno. Whirling stone, scrap iron, and bloody body body parts made the air impossible to breathe, filled as it was with limestone dust and gunpowder gases. Once more, we fought our way out with death just an inch behind us. All day we fought in this way, surrounded over and over again. We struggled on through narrow passages and back streets. Often, we passed right through the middle of the fighting line of other units. We always got through, but with steadily growing losses to our men. Sometimes we could take the wounded with us. Sometimes it was impossible, and they had to be left to await an enemy whose merciless brutality to SS men we knew only too well. The half-tracks had been sent back a long time before, and we fought as infantry with our automatic weapons, Panzerfaust, and hand grenades. We were hardly ever able to hold a position for more than an hour. Then we were forced to run another race with death in the middle of the Red Army soldiers. It was unbelievable what masses they managed to throw at us. Constantly they advanced with their wild yells, always supported by tanks, ever more tanks. Many of their tanks were knocked out, but new ones constantly arrived. Despite that, their infantry were lying in bloody mounds in the streets and backyards or were hanging out from smoke-blackened window openings. But no weakening in their attacking strength could be noticed. Their losses in this struggle must have been horrifying to any army commander at all, except for a Soviet marshal. But the reservoir did not dry up. There were still civilians everywhere. It was almost too late for them to try to escape the attacking Russians, who from the south had already advanced slightly west of Berlin and now were standing near Potsdam. Their assault had moved at such a breathtaking speed that the Berliners had had most escape routes cut off before they even knew what had happened. The people who had to stay went down into the shelters. They were cave dwellers in the 20th century. Down there they grouped together, waiting anxiously, agonizing, listening to the constantly approaching sounds of battle. They felt the vibrations and quiverings of the shell impacts and heard the houses collapsing above them. Tens of thousands of these terrified people were crushed under the falling masses of stone, or they were closed in from the outer world by a collapse to face an agonizing death by thirst and starvation that first drove them insane before death came and relieved them. Those who survived had to save every drop of water and every piece of bread as long as possible. To run up from the cellar to bring water from the tap on the nearest street corner was like running to meet death himself. In this city, there hardly remained any silent spot. Merciless shells always seemed to find an unfortunate victim, end quote. About 15 miles away, Zhukov and Konev both received an order from Stalin. Both men were given responsibility for capturing Berlin. However, Zhukov was given the real prize, the Reichstag. Here, the key symbolic goal for the entire Soviet Union was given to Zhukov. Whoever had his troops plant the red flag over the Reichstag would be the conqueror of Berlin. As far as history was concerned, and Stalin had just declared that man would be Zhukov. Privately, Konev was crushed, but publicly he put on a soldier's face and accepted his diminished role in the city's capture. And part of Konev's diminished role was using his forces to squeeze the desperate forces of the German Ninth Army operating about 20 miles below Berlin. The situation inside the Ninth Army was completely deteriorating. Many men no longer followed orders. Some units simply abandoned their positions on the front line and sought to escape to the west. But in the process, they exposed their fellow Germans who remained in their positions to withering attacks from their flanks. Night would come with two battalions next to your unit, and you'd wake up and your battalion found itself all alone with 40,000 well-equipped Russians trying to send you to the next life. By April 24th, confusion was everywhere, and we saw this reflected in the lack of intelligence Albert Speer saw at the situation conference he attended on April 23rd. Whole battalions with their officers were fleeing to the west. If Hitler didn't know what was going on, you can bet the local second lieutenant on the front line had no clue what was happening. One German major later recalled the breakdown in discipline he witnessed in the Ninth Army on April 24th like this, quote, "An artillery unit commandeered my fuel and fled to the Americans. Through lack of fuel, my own unit was reduced to 70% effectiveness, thereby reducing our own capacity to make a motorized breakout." At this point, resistance was only coming from the armored divisions, the SS, and from units from within the city. There was no longer any operational direction higher than the division itself. Units with unpopular officers were running away. Death sentences were no longer being carried out. From the orders given, the High Command was clearly demanding the constant sacrifice of our army, which was why our operational tasks made no sense. Everyone, every officer, was in the dark about what was really going on. The question arose whether to flee with one's troops on one's own responsibility or stay with the parent division, a question of conscience. I sent my adjutant home to his mother in Berlin by the last remaining route, as he was an only child. 1 hour later, the ring around us was closed, and I couldn't have sent him away if I had wanted to. The result of all this was incredible chaos, hassle, no sleep, no supplies, contaminated drinking water, unbelievable casualties, the encirclement constantly closing in, ferocious enemy airstrikes, and massive artillery bombardment continuously. During this phase, there was a visible sinking of morale in my own unit. The chief of staff had already fled, abandoning us. Unit leaders took control. The generals were no longer exercising their authority. End quote. Fighting around the Ninth Army took place everywhere. There was no definitive front line. Local unit leaders conducted counterattacks on their own initiative, while at the same time the unit next to them fled haphazardly. Thousands died on April 24th. It was a living nightmare. One 12-year-old boy named Heinz Dierberg was there. This is what he experienced, quote, "We were fleeing in a small group with our most precious belongings in a handcart along a woodland track. Crouching down on both sides of the track were German soldiers with their identifying emblems, their flags and patches, all their insignia cut off. They were actually armed with Soviet weapons, and we believe they were really Soviet troops setting a trap for German military forces. Luckily, they didn't attack us. A few hundred yards later, a Russian officer went through our small group and stole everything we had of value. Our personal property, our dignity, even our ability to move around freely had ceased to exist. We were a conquered people, and this is what it looked like." End quote. Meanwhile, in the air, the Soviets had total air superiority, and they flew thousands of sorties against the Germans, both in the Ninth Army pocket and in the city of Berlin itself. From the air, countless tanks, vehicles, horses, and masses of terrified humans were deconstructed. Because of this confusion and chaos, more than 40,000 German soldiers and civilians would lose their lives in the death throes of the Ninth Army. That doesn't include the wounded. Many men would never walk right again, never write again, never see again. The flip side of the so-called glory of war, and that doesn't include the men who were psychologically torn by their experience. For the civilians, April 24th was a day when the front line came to the city of Berlin itself. Tens of thousands were caught in between two fanatical armies fighting to the death. One historian describes the effect on the civilian population with these words, quote, "Berliners now referred to their city as the Reich's funeral pyre. Civilians were already suffering casualties in the street fighting and house clearing. Russian Captain Ratenko knocked on a cellar door. Nobody opened it, so he kicked it in. There was a burst of submachine gun fire, and he was killed. The soldiers from the 2nd Guards Tank Army who were with him started firing through the door and the windows. They killed the gunman, apparently a young officer in civilian clothes, but they also killed a woman and a child. The building was then surrounded by the Soviets and burned down. On April 24th, the 3rd Shock Army used its 5th Artillery Breakthrough Division on one narrow sector where the Germans had resisted bitterly. The heavy guns destroyed 17 houses, killing 120 defenders. The Soviet attackers claimed that in 4 of these houses, Germans had put out white flags of surrender and then fired again later. This became frequent in the fighting. Some soldiers, especially the Volkssturm, wanted to surrender and surreptitiously waved a white handkerchief, but more fanatical elements still fought on. The Germans mounted a counterattack with 3 assault guns, but this was thwarted by the heroism of Russian reconnaissance soldier Schulznick. Schulznick, having retrieved 3 Panzerfaust, took up position in a ruined house. A German shell exploded close to him, deafening him and covering him with debris. This did not stop him from engaging the assault guns as they approached. He set the first one on fire and damaged the second. The 3rd withdrew hurriedly. End quote. That night, in areas of the city which weren't on the front line, the mole-like civilians of Berlin huddled together in flak towers and basements. Now that all the police and military men in the city were actively fighting on the front line, law and order had begun to deteriorate. Stalled trains were robbed in broad daylight. When store owners refused to give supplies to civilians, the civilians pulled guns on the shopkeepers and took the supplies by force. Most shopkeepers broke down and let the looters steal their products. That way, their physical infrastructure, the shelving and building itself, weren't damaged in the looting. One of the scrambling locusts feeding on the bones of Berlin was an anonymous female diarist. Heavy fighting had finally come to her neighborhood. The front line was just a few miles away, and millions of civilians shivered in fear. Often people cuddled with one another, giving in to a primordial need to feel secure in the midst of widespread insecurity. Some gave in to sexual excess under the pressure. This was one German woman's impression of the city at the time. Quote, "In the darkness of night, smoke and red skies filled the horizon. The east is all ablaze. The Russians are already moving towards the city center. People joke about Hitler. Just think about how much better off we'd be if his old lady had had a miscarriage. This morning, a group of us women were told to report to the hospital to work as volunteers. When we reached the hospital, the whole place was filled with smoke. Men were running about wildly, screaming. An ambulance driver said, 'Hey, we've got a shot lung with an impacted bullet. Move! Go away! Didn't you hear? We don't have a single bed left!' The driver was fuming. 'This is where we were told to go! Go away or else!' The sergeant threatens with his fist. The driver storms off, cursing. Lightly wounded men go slinking through the corridor. One barefoot, his bleeding hand wrapped in his socks. Another, also barefoot, leaves bloody footprints as he walks. The soles of his feet squish as he lifts them off the ground. Waxy yellow faces peek out of head bandages with rapidly spreading stains of red. We look into two or three other rooms. It's very stuffy. Smells of men, soiled bedding, nervous apprehension. One man snarls at us, 'What do you want?' The woman who had come to get us to volunteer shyly answered the man that a man in a truck had driven by shouting that the field hospital needed women to help. 'That's nonsense. We don't have anything for you to do here. Go back home.' So they don't want female help. But what a peculiar tone, so dismissive, disdainful, as if we wanted to get our hands on the guns or play at being soldiers. Once again, I have to relearn everything I've been taught about women in war. Once our role was to play the ministering angel, scraping up lint for bandages, a cool hand on a man's hot brow, at a healthy distance from the shooting. Now there's no difference between a regular hospital and a field hospital. The front line is everywhere. Admittedly, this particular hospital is trying to remain a kind of island in the midst of the storm. The roof is painted with gigantic crosses, and white sheets have been spread out in the form of a cross in the yard in front of the building. But aerial mines are impartial, and the carpet of bombs is tightly woven with no holes for compassion, which they know in the field hospital. Otherwise, they wouldn't have crammed everyone down in the basement the way they have. Men's faces peer out of every barred window." End quote. On the night of April 24th, all the hospital beds in the city were taken. More makeshift hospitals were set up, of course, but that's just what they were, makeshift. Many men would die in teeth-grinding agony because of a lack of attention or the lack of a few basic items such as running water, pain beyond pain, tribulation beyond tribulation, tragedy beyond tragedy. And that's another one in the books for me. Once again, I want to thank everybody who leaves those 5-star reviews, everybody who writes in, everybody who donates. There's too many of you to name. I appreciate every single one of you, including you, Carlton. We've got many more years together, and I hope you'll ride with me in the decades to come. But now I've got to address an email I got from Jack in Willington, North Dakota. Jack wants to know if I plan on taking deep dives into history and conflicts like I have with the Battle of Berlin. Well, Jack, the answer is yes and no. For many battles, the sources are so few that it would be impossible to take a deep dive like this into all of them, like I'm doing for the Battle of Berlin. In addition, not every conflict in human history deserves such an in-depth analysis because, frankly, they aren't as important. The outcome of the Battle of Berlin changed the world. It actually tangibly changed Western civilization and decided the fate of many nations. Moreover, I've always wanted to really take a battle apart, and Berlin is one I've always been interested in. But to answer your question, the answer is yes and no. The historical content itself and the reception of each episode will guide me as I continue to produce this show. That and listener suggestions. Honestly, though, I can tell you from extensive research into the American Civil War that most battles in human history simply don't have the tremendous amount of resources that the Battle of Berlin has generated throughout the years. In other words, it would be nearly impossible to cover most battles in human history with this much rigorous detail. All right, that's all I got for you this month, brothers. Until next time, I'm Dr. Luke Wolf, and I'm wishing you good times and good weather with good people. Bye.